they were saying when they think you cannot hear. If you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear. If you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few. If they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed with Margaret Flowers. Clearing the Fog is a project of popularresistance.org. You can subscribe to it at Apple, SoundCloud, MixCloud, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can also find Clearing the Fog at popularresistance.org. And while you're there, you can subscribe to the free Daily Digest. Each morning, you'll receive an email that has summaries of the articles posted the day before. This is a great way to keep up with movement news and analysis. This week, I interviewed Patrick Lawrence. Patrick is a longtime journalist reporting from overseas in Asia for several decades. He's written a number of books, and his newest book is called Journalists and Their Shadows. And in that, it's part biographical, but he really chronicles how the media has changed since the Cold War, when it became kind of an arm of the state, and then efforts to try to change that in the, you know, 70s and so, and then now returning again to a time when the media is really being dismantled, the corporate or mainstream media, and has really, instead of fulfilling its role of challenging power and holding power accountable, has really become an arm of power. And so Patrick talks about ways that journalists and media outlets are trying to get around that, the rise of alternative media, of independent media. And this seems to be something that's in the air right now. Canadian Dimension has an article where they report on private equity, the impact of that on the Canadian media, where they're not allowed to have nonprofit media. And the private equity has been buying up media, as has happened in the United States as well, stripping the outlets of their assets, firing employees, and then asking the government to provide subsidies to them. And, you know, the impact that this is having on Canadians' ability to get independent information. In that same article, they write about the rise of nonprofit media in the United States. Chris Hedges reports, and his most recent Chris Hedges report is on the crisis in media, that in 2023, 2.5 U.S. papers went out of business each week, that since 2005, two-thirds of journalists in the United States have lost their jobs, and a third of all U.S. papers have permanently closed. But there is a trend towards nonprofit media in the United States, and this is something I wasn't aware of, but in 2019, the Salt Lake Tribune in Salt Lake City, Utah, became a nonprofit. Also in 2022, the Chicago Sun-Times merged with Chicago Public Media, became a nonprofit. The Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News were bought up and then transferred to a nonprofit entity, and then the Portland Press Herald was bought by the Maine Trust for local news. So lots of efforts around the country to try to preserve our media. And why is this important? Without an independent media, people just don't have information about what's actually happening. And as we know, such little dependability of our corporate media to report on the truth, as Patrick talks about, particularly his experience with the New York Times and how the New York Times is covering the situation in Palestine right now. Also in the news, talking about media, is the Julian Assange hearing is taking place in the United Kingdom right now in the High Court. It's an appeals hearing that is taking place on February 20th and 21st. Julian Assange, a journalist and publisher with WikiLeaks, has been held in prison now since 2019 after he was arrested in the Ecuadorian embassy where he had been seeking refuge for 7 years. You know, he's not been convicted of a single crime. He has not committed a crime. And yet he has been severely punished, very severe conditions at Belmarsh Prison where he's being held. This has had a big impact on his health. He's married. He has two young sons. And he hasn't committed a crime, but he's being punished anyway. So there's a lot of concern that this high court will not allow his extradition to be stopped. He's being extradited to the United States to face charges here, which could result in up to 175 years in prison, something that's considered a death sentence for him. And that in itself should prevent his extradition, as the original judge, Vanessa Beritzer, ruled that he should not be extradited to the United States because of his health concerns, and that that could lead to his death in the U.S. But the U.K., under the influence of the United States, is continuing to go ahead with this. Last week, I think I reported, Australian members of parliament voted to call for the end of the prosecution against Julian Assange. There have been a lot of efforts in the United States to push the Department of Justice and the Biden administration to drop the prosecution, something that President Biden could do very easily. He could make a phone call, send a letter to the Department of Justice and say, stop the prosecution. Then Julian Assange, there would be no reason to hold him in prison. He could be free to return home to his family and possibly return to his home country of Australia. But given how things have been unfolding and the Biden administration's reluctance to do anything for Julian Assange, that doesn't look good. So we need to be prepared to mobilize to protest if Julian Assange is extradited to the United States. His hearings will be held in Alexandria, Virginia. And so there have already been efforts this week. There are actions taking place across the United States in New York City, Boston, Denver, Chicago, Milwaukee, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C. And then we need to be prepared to mobilize, because he could be extradited relatively quickly to the United States if the high court does not allow the extradition to be stopped. Let's talk a little bit about what's happening in Palestine. Monda Weiss reports that more than 29,000 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have been killed since October 7th. Estimates are that if you lump into that the number of people who are missing, it's probably closer to 36.5 thousand people who have been killed in Gaza. More than 69,000 people have been wounded. And in the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, more than 380 Palestinians have been murdered. You know, in the occupied West Bank, settlers, Israeli settlers, have been armed and given the go-ahead and support to attack Palestinians or move them from their homes. And in the Gaza Strip, there have been unprecedented attacks on hospitals there throughout the Gaza Strip, and a real collapse of the medical system there while so many people are being injured. On Sunday, at the Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, Sunday marked several days of attacks on the hospital there. It is now, as of Sunday, effectively out of operation. There are 200 people reported to still be in the hospital without electricity, water, or food, or the ability to get medical supplies in. So not only are people dying from the direct attack on them, but also dying because of lack of oxygen, electricity, medicines. And there's been a lot of controversy globally about Israel's plans to attack, have a ground assault on Rafah. They've already been launching naval and air attacks on Rafah. But Israel says that it plans to go on with that assault on Rafah. Netanyahu rejected a deal recently with Hamas. So there's no movement there on ending the assault on Gazans. At the same time, the aid is not getting in through Rafah, through the Rafah border crossing with Egypt to Palestinians, not only because they're not allowing it through the checkpoint, you know, the border, but there are Israeli settlers who are trying to block that aid from getting in. And then even if the aid is getting in, there's been such attacks on the infrastructure, it's difficult to get the aid to where the people are. And then when people do go to the aid trucks to get supplies, the Israeli occupying forces attack them there. Many people are starving right now in the Gaza Strip, particularly in the northern part, where people are having to eat whatever plants they can find, animal feed, whatever they can do to stay alive. This is, you know, this is really unprecedented, because in war, people are not supposed to be denied medical care or food, and the press is supposed to be protected as well. But as we know, so many press people, reporters, photographers have been murdered by the Israeli occupying forces. And then Ramadan, the holy month of Ramadan, begins on March 10th, but the Netanyahu government is announcing restrictions on access of Muslims to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in East Jerusalem, another assault on the rights of Palestinians. And the Netanyahu government also recently announced that it rejects any recognition of Palestine as a state. And not only are settlers attacking Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and refugee camps there, but the Israeli occupying forces are attacking them as well. Now, there have been several resolutions before the United Nations Security Council to call for a ceasefire by Israel. And the newest resolution submitted by the country of Algeria, the United States is already threatening to veto that ceasefire resolution. So the U.S. government, the Biden administration, is doing everything that it can to support Israel and continue this genocidal assault on Palestinians. We can only hope that the international bodies, the International Court of Justice, is hearing right now testimony on what's happening, you know, the war crimes of Israel, as well as the ICC is also getting ready to start hearing, finally, the evidence of war crimes being committed by the state of Israel. And Israel's been very clear that its plan is to clear Gaza of Palestinians. They've been trying to push them into Egypt, been trying to get other countries to take Palestinians. Palestinians, many of whom have already been displaced from their homes in Palestine, pushed into the largest open-air prison in Gaza, are refusing to leave because that would be the end of Palestine if the Palestinians are pushed out. Egypt has begun construction of a walled camp in the Sinai Desert near the Rafah border. It's an 8-square-mile walled camp, concentration camp, that they say could hold up to 100,000 Palestinians if they are forced through that border crossing into Egypt by an assault by the Israeli occupying forces. The resistance and support of Palestinian liberation continues, and just recently, Faculty for Justice in Palestine formed. This is a national coalition of faculty to support students who are being targeted for their activism in solidarity with Palestine. 80 campuses so far are part of that. They say they are committed to Palestinian liberation through education, advocacy, and action. They want to support students, many of whom have been suspended or have faced academic repercussions simply for their advocacy for Palestinian liberation. And then there's a new National Labor Network for Ceasefire that represents 9 million union members in the United States. This is formed by 7 national unions and more than 200 local unions, and their goal is to push President Biden to call for a ceasefire. And then finally, just a quick report on what's happening with Yemen, one of the first countries to act under the Genocide Convention to try to stop Israel from conducting genocide of Palestinians through their blockade of the Red Sea, preventing weapons and other supplies getting into Israel. Of course, that was met with the United States and United Kingdom sending ships there, as well as attacking the country of Yemen, killing Yemenis there. The Yemeni military has been attacking ships bound to Israel, as well as U.S. and U.K. warships, and shooting down drones. And now the European Union is joining in, sending warships to the Red Sea. This includes France, Germany, Italy, and Belgium. And this is the largest battle, naval battle, that the United States has conducted since the end of World War II. 7,000 U.S. sailors have been sent to that area. So this really risks continued escalation into a broader regional war. So with that, I will take a short musical break and come back with the interview with Patrick Lawrence.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. father standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds just, who are people gonna rise up and get their share? People gonna rise up and take what's there.
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed with Margaret Flowers. And now I turn to my guest, Patrick Lawrence. Patrick is a journalist and an author. He has covered Asia and been a foreign correspondent for a number of decades. He has written a few books, but the newest one is Journalists and Their Shadows by Clarity Press, looking how journalism has changed the state that it's in and what we can do to save it. So, Patrick, thank you so much for taking time to join me today.
You know, Margaret, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start out by talking about your book, and this is partly a biography. But let's begin with the title, Journalists and Their Shadows, because I found this concept very interesting and one that I think could also be applied to many other realms. But can you talk a little bit about what you mean by their shadows?
Sure. I borrowed from Jung to arrive at that construct, if that's what we call it. And, you know, here and there in numerous of his books, Jung makes the point that we all have shadows. And what he meant by that, I'm going to have to simplify, I hope not too much. What he meant by that, we have selves that are, not revealed, you know, the necessities of convention, employment, socialization, and so forth, cause us to obscure our private selves, right? That's Jung, and Jung borrowed from Nietzsche, so far as I can make out. And journalists do this too. Now, the reason I spent some time on this thought, I introduce it in the introduction in the first chapter, but it's threaded throughout the book, is because the shadows of journalists are immensely consequential. This is because of the place journalists occupy in society. If journalists have sort of a presented self, and then they have an obscured self, a shadow self, right? To be employed in my profession, I'm speaking now of the mainstream, requires that one detach from one's shadow self. Okay, I imagine your listeners will at this point understand the very important consequences of this, right? Journalists tend not to write what they mean because they have to please their employers and so forth, right? And what do you get? Well, you get journalism is distorted by this, okay? I decided, you know, nobody's ever taken this up. I can't imagine a single journalist who reads the book or listens to us today would not understand what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's very prevalent. I know a very great many mainstream journalists would deny what I'm saying because they must remain gainfully employed. But I thought, you know, this has to be brought out. And to conclude this thought, what do I think about this phenomenon of the journalist and his or her shadow, right? And where might this go? My answer is, it is in independent media, which is my corner of the garden now. It is in independent media that we can become once again one with our shadows. and write what we mean, write what we see and hear, without reference to what an employer might require of us. You know,
right.
a corollary point I make in the book: journalists do not write for readers; they write for publishers and senior editors. They are required, if they want to get paid, to please them. That's another source of distortion in the profession.
Right.
So, you know, this is the argument I make at the beginning of the book. I discuss the shadow, right? At the other end, we come out the other end of the book with a strong argument for the significance of independent journal, independent publications and media, so far as any kind of promising future for the profession may be.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, it's really about someone being their authentic self versus
thank you for the word. Exactly.
Yeah, being who they, which is fundamental for everyone, that there's, that they have authenticity. Otherwise, it creates a lot of mental turmoil.
Yeah, I mean, I take up this word authenticity. Thank you again for it, right? We all have this sort of, if I can use the word loosely, this kind of bifurcation in our consciousness, our personalities, right? Authenticity, we're a very big word for the existentialist, right? The authentic self, right? Sartre was very long on the notion of authenticity. And, you know, we all need to pay attention to this. We all need to understand it, right?
Right.
No question of that. You know, Sartre related the question of the authentic self as a source of, as the source of our freedom. Right? But again, I find it, I consider it essential, especially consequential in the case of journalists, because of what they do, the importance of their work as figures in public space and so on, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Who really shape the public dialogue. And
exactly.
And but I come from it. I come to it from a background of being a pediatrician and child development, and just how critical it is for children as they're raised to be able to be authentic and, you know, to be healthy. And I think, you know, the medical profession, the way that the U.S. healthcare system is, physicians and other health professionals cannot be their authentic selves within that
right.
system. I feel like this is a concept that I agree with you. In journalism, it's very important because of that public role. But I think it's something that people could resonate with in a lot of ways.
Yeah. The presented self and the authentic self.
Right. Right.
And so, a lot of journalists are so far into the presented self, they would listen to us talking, you know, they're so buried, you know, they're so unaware of their position. They might say, "What are these people talking about?" Well, that's just a form of denial, or what do we want to say, Margaret? Willful ignorance.
Right,
you know?
Right. Well, I remember having a conversation about similar, you know, with Chris Hedges about his time at the New York Times, and he basically said that people who are able to rise up through those institutions are people who are willing to kind of sacrifice that part of themselves and play the
I
game.
Imagine Chris, I don't know Chris well, I gather you know him perhaps better than I do, but I know his career trajectory. I would be shocked if he didn't understand exactly what we are talking about.
Yeah, I think when we look at folks like, you know, Seymour Hersh, who can,
yeah.
doing incredible work and can't get published in the New York Times, you know, has
yeah.
to publish on
Sigh.
Substack.
Good
yeah.
old sigh.
So you actually wrote an article recently in Consortium News that I think is a good illustration of what you talk about in the book, the crisis at the New York Times.
Yeah.
And how the coverage of the conflict in Palestine.
A minor correction, credit where due. That I wrote that for Sheer Post.
For Sheer Post, okay. And it was
and
reposted.
Consortium, Joe Loria, Consortium's editor, picks up a good deal of my stuff
right.
from at Sheer Post, and
right.
it flows in the other way too. SharePost picks up a lot of my stuff from Consortium.
So that was originally in SharePost, Bob Shear's
Yeah.
publication. But can you talk a little bit about how the current genocide that's happening in Palestine? Because I think what was interesting in that is that towards the end of that article, you write about how there is some turmoil, it seems, happening within the New York Times over this coverage.
A few people have done really exemplary work on this matter, okay, to take your listeners back to the beginning very, very briefly. The Times newsroom has been in a kind of percolating state uproar since the beginning of the Gaza catastrophe. And to go back further, the Times's coverage of Israel has been a source of contention in the newsroom for a very, very, very long time. I mean, we're counting, we're going way, way back, okay? What caused these animosities to burst rather dramatically into the open, inside, I'm talking about the paper, is a lengthy piece by a correspondent named Jeffrey Gettleman. Jeffrey Gettleman, he made a mark for himself as an Africa correspondent. And somewhere along the line, he got a Pulitzer, I'm not sure for what. And last autumn, they had put him in Ukraine to help with the coverage there. Times has all sorts of different people in Ukraine, right? On October 7th, either the evening of the 7th or the morning of the 8th, they put Gettleman on a train to Israel. I'm not sure Gettleman had ever previously covered Israel or the Middle East, but we have pretty good reason to wonder whether he hadn't, because he walked right straight into the Israeli propaganda machine and got himself in extremely serious trouble. Right after the October 7th events, the Israeli propagandists started coming on with stories of rape, sexual violence, and all that sort of thing. The imagery, as I put in the column we're talking about, was worthy of a bloody B movie, right? Crazy stuff, right? Completely preposterous, right? Very beyond credibility.
Right.
Gettleman reproduced this stuff, right? In a long takeout, by my count, 3,700 words. And what happened in the course of this was Gettleman's piece served to expose the routinized relationship between correspondents, certainly Times correspondents, but not only Times correspondents, the routinized relationship between American correspondents and indeed Western correspondents and the Israeli propagandists, right? He ran a mile with all this stuff that the Israelis fed him. And part of the routine is you get the story from the Israelis, sexual violence, and then graduated to systematic sexual violence, weaponized sexual violence, right? Sexual violence by design. And then you dress that up with interviews and interviews and interviews. So what comes out on page one looks like an independent piece of work, right? Well, the story began to collapse within a couple of days of publication. Mm-hmm. And this brings me back to the people I mentioned earlier who have done good work. I'll mention The Gray Zone, Max Blumenthal, and his colleague Aaron Mate. I don't know how the duties were divided there. A website I think is published in the Middle West called Mondo Vice, which is more exclusively dedicated to Palestinian and Israeli affairs. Right? The Intercept did a piece. I'm a bit mad at The Intercept because they drew heavily on Max's work, but never named Max or the Gray Zone. They just kept referring to critics. That's kind of like a not dot, but you give credit where it's due. But that's just professional stuff, right? Yeah, they did excellent work. And by the time Gettleman's major piece came out, The Big Takeout, on December 28th, he was way over the top. And I'll conclude here. The Times has, in the techno age, they have a podcast called The Daily. The Daily is where they showcase boast of their work they're most proud of. And The Daily was supposed to do a long segment on Gettleman's piece. Well, by the time the producers of The Daily had finished their work, the piece was falling apart, so they had to pull it, and they wrote another script taking account of some of the errors. And The Times has now got itself in a fix that you just simply wouldn't believe if you couldn't see it. One, the Daily can run the original segment and put its name on discredited work, or two, it can run the revised segment and discredit Gettleman all by itself. I mean, can you think of a more ridiculous sort of Hobson's choice, Margaret? You know?
Right.
So it's a big mess. And I think I picked it up because it's so exposing of how Western media function. And the more readers and viewers who understand this, the better.
Right.
It's also one final point. It's also very exemplary of the role and responsibilities of independent media as legacy media, such as The Times, betray their responsibilities.
Yeah. So you've kind of watched how media has changed through
yes.
your career. Can you talk a little bit about where you see that kind of that corporate media? And it extends down to local media, I think, as well, in a lot of ways. I remember fighting a fracked gas export terminal in Southern Maryland, the first one in the world to be built literally in a residential community across the street from homes, which is never done. And the local papers would print whatever the corporation Dominion sent them. And then when we wrote factual responses, we were always fact-checked and questioned and edited. And it was like...
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I'm not a great believer in golden ages, okay? I make that point early in the book. American newspapers and broadcasters have long had, let's be courteous, problematic relations with power. And we mean political power, we mean corporate power, we mean financial power, because a lot of these publications are now part of listed, Wall Street listed companies, right? What I wanted to do with the book, in part, is give the crisis that now confronts us a history. What's going on now, the sort of corruptions you just described in Baltimore context, the censorship, the distortions, the unacceptable relation, the corrupted relations with power, right? That's very key. Journalism is supposed to function as an independent pole of power, That's what the notion of the fourth estate was all about. The fourth is even the phrase the fourth estate sits there like a dusty antique at this point. But that's, all of that is going on now. In addition, the censorship and so the cell, I'm sure your listeners know at least some of what I'm talking about, right? I'll elaborate if you wish. But to get right to the point, it has a history. We've been through this before. That was my point. I lived through the Cold War, all but its first few years. I was of age and began in the profession by mid-Cold War. So I saw all this. And it is absolutely astonishing the extent to which what we see now is a very, very faithful reproduction of what was going on then. We have no grounds whatsoever to look back with disapproval, disdain, contempt, whatever, at what went on in the 50s. We're doing the exact same thing. And why is this going on again? Why this repetition? This perverse reprise of all the errors of the 50s and 60s? Because media never then acknowledge these errors, and if you don't acknowledge your mistakes, you cannot learn from them. It will they learn again this time? But it don't look too likely,
No,
right?
no.
And again, independent media are, to my mind, they are where the dynamism of this profession lies. Short of resources, yes. Short of people with professional training, and yes, they're out there, but their responsibilities are outsized to their resources. But that doesn't detract, that doesn't counter my point. They are where the dynamism of this profession lies. And that piece we're talking about is a textbook example of what I'm talking about. Independent media brought some truth to a very, very dishonest set of transactions between the New York Times and the Israeli authorities.
And I remember we were involved in organizing the Occupy movement back in 2011, and there was a lot of excitement at that time because we were gaining new tools, new media tools. That was around the time, WikiLeaks had been created, and people were getting access to information through WikiLeaks, but we also people were able to use their phones to live stream events, put them out through social media, reach people. And then there's been a response to that since then of changing algorithms so that independent, can't, there's a there, demonetization of people.
You lead me to a very important observation, I think, right? Independent media are by and large digital. I guess there are a few exceptions, but we are dependent on websites and digital publishing. That's obvious. What does that mean? I mean, on the one hand, these new technologies, digital technologies, have made possible the emergence of independent media as a force in American discourse. There's no question of that. But they also leave us, we must not flinch from this, they leave us extremely vulnerable because these digital media are these platforms are provided by very large corporations, they can pull the plug anytime they wish, and that should be perfectly obvious because they've pulled it many times already, right? It's daunting, it's quite daunting.
I think there are
if
a lot of challenges for media right now. I mean, the lack of access to information. Journalists wanting to interview, you know, people within the federal government have to have PR minders there to oversee what the employees of the government are saying.
That's right. You know, Margaret, I remember when I was a correspondent in Asia, specifically my Tokyo years, right? You used to be able to go along to the American embassy and talk to the political attaché or the military attaché or what have you whenever you wanted, or the deputy chief of mission and so on, right? Somewhere around the mid 80s, I started calling the embassy. American diplomats are not terribly good. I didn't call the embassy all that often, right? Americans don't need diplomacy the way other nations do. So we field a rather inferior foreign service, with exceptions. You call the embassy, and the person you want to talk to would tell you, well, you have to call the public relations department because I need their permission to talk to you. And when we organize our time together, you're welcome to come in, but somebody from communications will have to sit with us.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. It gets a bit Soviet, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes.
You know?
And then the criminalization of journalists.
Yeah.
Of journalism.
Yeah. Let us spend a minute honoring Julian Assange, given there are extremely important hearings coming up the 20th and the 21st, I think.
Right. That's his appeal before the High Court. Right.
Yeah.
And he could be extradited immediately after that.
Yeah. It's frightening.
Mm-hmm. And that, you know, what is the impact of that on, I mean, even now, you know, before he may be extradited and go through a process here, what does that say to journalists around the world that the United States can go after any journalist anywhere that reports unfavorably or?
Yeah. I mean, I think the cover in the Assange case is he's not a journalist.
Right.
Okay. One of the really curious and rather perverse dimensions of the Assange case is the material WikiLeaks was publishing around 2010 was their big year.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's
was reproduced in the Times, the Guardian, what have you, right?
Right.
One of the complications since then is, well, if we go after Assange, what are we going to do about the Times?
Mm-hmm.
And so they've drawn this distinction. He's not a journalist. It doesn't hold any water.
Right.
But a lot of things that don't hold water go on in Washington under the law, right? What is it going to mean for journalists in the future? I.F. Stone used to say, every generation produces but few genuine, authentic journalists. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of many are called, few are chosen, right?
Mm-hmm.
The number of people in the profession who are going to come up against the national security state in the way Assange did, and publish material concerning covert operations and so
mm-hmm.
on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is probably not that many, right? Most people in the profession, mainstream, are very, very pathetically, they're just getting paid.
Right, they're very compliant.
But, yeah, but those few who, I mean, another thing, Margaret, where post Assange, if I can use that, and post the 2010 revelations, Chelsea Manning, Assange, etc. Who would publish explosive material such as Assange published 14, 15 years ago, right? The whole media scene has changed so radically. I think you're right that it will seriously dampen what journalists do and even can are permitted to do in the future. But I don't think we should elevate mainstream journalism to the pedestal it likes to play they like to it likes to place itself on, right? I think the WikiLeaks thing has already had an effect. If you'll check me on this, see what tell me what you think. I think the WikiLeaks thing has already had a very pernicious effect. It seems to me unthinkable, well, close to unthinkable, that a paper like the New York Times would publish Iraq war logs, Guantanamo diary, or whatever they called it, you know, all these explosively revelatory reports based on thorough, incontrovertible documentation. Where, you know, help me out here. Who would touch that material now? What do
Well,
you think?
you know better than I do, I think, with that, you know, the connections between major outlets and the security state, and you know how much of that is vetted, what they
Oh,
write, and you know, and
I mean,
so there, it takes courage. You
yeah.
know, people like Assange have courage to do this work, and that's not something you find in a lot of professions.
And once again, where does this line of inquiry lead us, Margaret? It leads us right back to independent media. I think they're the only ones who would go near this stuff. A point you just made, I'd like to elaborate on briefly, right? The New York Times has told us on page one on numerous occasions, one of them being in the course of handling the WikiLeaks revelations 14 years ago, that they indeed check with the government as to what they are permitted to publish and what the policy cliques in Washington would rather they didn't. David Sanger, correspondents like that, will actually tell you this if you look carefully. It's there in the archives, you know. It's you know, it comes down to a lot of the ills of the profession come down to this one thing. I make the point early in the book. If there's one topic in that book that runs all the way through it is the question of power and the relationship of media to power. It's sick. It's diseased. You know, it's I don't mean to, well, it's a bit Soviet once again, right?
Well, you know, and for me, as someone who's engaged in activism, getting accurate information, you know, you see so much misinformation that comes out in the corporate media. You know, you're working on an issue. I remember the campaign we were fighting the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a huge trade
Oh,
agreement.
the old TPP, yeah.
Exactly. And just how the White House would put out bald-faced lies about, you know, and it was usually a Friday afternoon. And then we'd have to work so hard to get out the correct information. Because I think, and I'd like to get your opinion on this, media literacy in the United States, you've been all over the world. How discerning do you think in general is the US public? In terms of looking at the media and being able to tell what's accurate information and what to question.
You know, that's a tricky question, a very good one. I tend to give the American public more credit than many others for its awareness of what is going on, and the extent to which mainstream media, legacy media, corporate media, whatever we want to call them, have been discredited. Okay. It is very true that the New York Times, to a lesser extent, the Post, Wash Post, and all the other major dailies and so on, have, you know, their traditional readerships, viewerships, and they are large. That's true. But if you look at the things like the Pew polls and so forth, trust in media could not. I think it's at a record low. There was a Pew poll
That is true,
in
yeah.
2000, 2020, 2021, 2022. What percent of Americans trust what they read in the newspapers? I assume you're sitting down, Margaret.
Yeah.
16%.
Well.
Let's go to television. What percentage of Americans trust what they see and hear on TV? 11%.
Well.
Now, let's use that as a mirror. I like to do, I used to do this as a correspondent. Somebody says or does something, you use it as a mirror. What prompted them to say or do that? What's going on, right? Well, why? What do we learn from these statistics? We learn that these mainstream media are they're simply not trusted anymore. They are, once again, they're not, I mean, if you listen to these people talk about this, there is no problem in mainstream media. They're doing a great job, right? The problem is the reading and viewing public. They really need to be educated so they understand, right? They just don't get it. That's the stance. So they're not going and what we learn from that is they're not going to address this question forthrightly. I think it's a, I made this point in the book. I think it's an altogether healthy thing that people don't trust media, mainstream media. Independent media are not nearly as large, and they don't project nearly to the extent one would wish. At the moment, the American reading and viewing public is to a certain extent forsaken. You know, where do they go? I get remarks in my the comment threads to my columns once in a while. Thank you for reading the New York Times, so I don't have to,
Right.
or after the comment thread attached to that column that brings us together today, right? Numerous people said, "God, I haven't read the Times in years." Right?
Right.
I haven't read the Times since they betrayed my trust with the weapons of mass destruction nonsense in 2002, 2003, right?
Right.
So this is the drift of things,
Right.
and I think it's to the credit of American readers and viewers, right, that they're catching on to this.
Right.
But it's a dynamic process, Margaret, you know.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I remember in the 2010s being very excited about the possibility of democratizing the media, and it's the state
I
fought back.
remember
It's
that.
been a it's been a you know, it's becoming more and more difficult. Before we go, I did want to ask you about your thoughts about what's happening right now in West Asia, because the genocide that's unfolding before our eyes, the unflinching support by the Biden administration to continue providing support to the Israeli state, and then the axis of resistance and their fight back, you know, what's happening with Yemen. What are your thoughts on what's happening and where that's going, this is something I'm not hearing discussed enough, I don't think, in the US.
Well, if you listen to the policy people in Washington, Blinken and so on, Sullivan and the others, Burns, the CIA director, the talk now is, you know, what we will do post-Gaza. Hamas has to go. We have to reconstitute the Palestinian Authority. Good luck with that. We have to construct a relationship between Saudi Arabia and Israel et cetera, et cetera. And we have to get going on the two-state solution. Good luck with that too, right? So what's the subtext here? We were talking about this before we went on the air. The subtext here is all will return to some form of normality, right?
Right.
I find that some combination of stupid and hubristic, right?
Right.
I think this crisis in Gaza is a is it, it is going to emerge, and the historians will get at this eventually. A major turning point in Middle Eastern history, and I would say in human history, to the extent the Israelis have degraded, dragged all of us into the immorality and disgrace they've made of themselves, right? I don't think there's any going back from this,
Right,
right?
right.
I think the American presence in the Middle East is very likely, I'm pretty confident of this, to encounter considerably more and sharper resistance.
Right.
It will be considerably more difficult for the Americans to operate there. And the Israelis, I've said this in print already, they're a pariah state now, right?
Right. I mean, if you have Australia, Japan, Jordan coming out, Joseph Borrell challenging Biden, who said, if you care
That was
about
a
Palestinian
remarkable
lives,
statement.
don't send them
That was
weapons. Yeah.
that fellow Borrell is a bit of a wild card, but that was a remarkable
Yeah.
statement he made the other day, right?
Right.
I think I mean, look, we're invited to make the comparison. Israel is an apartheid state now, right? It seems to me we can legitimately consider comparisons between the Israel of 2024 and the South Africa of, let's say, the 70s and 80s, 80s, right? I'd like to see things like BDS take, get some serious traction.
Right.
Somebody remarked the other day, the B and the D are okay. It's the S that we have to work on, right? The sanctions.
But that's starting to happen. There are calls within the European Union to start cutting ties with Israel, and some countries are doing
I
that.
think to conclude this,
Yeah.
I think Israel has, and the United States have asked too much of humanity. You can starve Venezuelans. You can brutalize innocent Syrians if you want. These things are very far
Destroy
away.
Libya, yeah.
People don't pay sufficient attention. It's very unfortunate, but in this case, they have asked way too much of humanity. They've asked too much of mine, and the humanity of and the decency, the morality, altogether, what makes us human? They've asked us to surrender all this, the consciences,
Right.
and it's they've asked too much. They've
Right.
stepped way over the line, and in consequence, I don't think, to conclude, I don't think there's any coming back from this.
Right. Well, out of crisis comes opportunity, and I think that's one of the
Good thought.
underlying themes of your book is that we've been here before in terms of the state of journalism. There are ways that we can get out of this, and so I think your book is a real call to people to make that real.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
So, well, Patrick, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today.
You're very welcome, Margaret. Always nice. I wish you well.
Thank you. You've been listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed. I'm Margaret Flowers. My guest today was Patrick Lawrence. I'll go out with a song by Junkyard Empire. It's called We Want.
We'll lift our brothers and our sisters. We'll lift the people together, can overthrow.